This is Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. Every week, we review an episode of the cult classic time travel series and decide whether it holds up to present-day viewing. And hopefully, we'll entertain you along the way. Be sure to check us out on our website, fwwquantumleappod.com, and also on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram under Fate's Wide Wheel. And be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Leapers. Thank you for tuning in to Fate's Wide Wheel once again. This is a special episode. As promised, we are releasing our full unedited interview with David Anthony Marshall. We thought that it warranted your ears because it turned out to be a really fun and interesting conversation that not only touched upon his work in Quantum Leap, but sci-fi as a genre in both film and television, and kind of tracing a little bit of the history of his career as an actor and how it relates to not only, you know, our favorite television show, but other pieces of genre television and film. And I think it takes some really interesting twists and turns along the way as it relates to entertainment and society and culture and pop culture. So we certainly wanted to give our listeners an opportunity to hear from David, who is a really great guy and interesting and wonderful conversationalist. And he talks about some of the projects that he's working on now. So we obviously encourage you to check those out. You can, of course, find him on Facebook at David Anthony Marshall and also via his website, which is davidanthonymarshall.com. And again, you know, we just had a really good time chatting with him, and hopefully we'll get the chance to maybe do so again in the future. Again, you can connect with him online at davidanthonymarshall.com or on his Facebook page, which is, of course, facebook.com/ChicagoMarshall, two L's on the end of there. And of course, he is playing music in the Evanston and Chicago area. So if you are in the area, you should definitely go and check out one of his musical projects that he mentions here on the podcast. Of course, we're all dealing with our own level of shutdown, lockdown, quarantine, social distancing. So what better time to curl up with your favorite or one of your favorite podcasts and check out this interview. Things kind of start in media res. We jumped into the conversation before the tape was really rolling. We didn't do much of an intro. You know, there wasn't even really a hi, how are you? It was literally the conversation just started. So recording starts kind of in the middle of things, but you didn't miss anything. I'm plopping you right in at the beginning of what we have. And you can stay tuned afterwards for brief words, the outro, Fate's Wide Wheel. Thank you guys again. Take care of yourselves. Take care of one another. And we'll talk to you soon. We're also dropping Killin' Time around the same time as this, which you may have already listened to before getting to this. And, of course, Starlight, Star Bright will be coming at you very soon. Dennis and I are planning on recording quite a bit over the next week or two as we're both staying in and staying well, which we hope that you all are doing also. So, thanks again. Enjoy the interview, and I'll be right back.
They left it, apparently. I didn't watch the entire, all of it, all the time. I love the show, you know what I mean? But I didn't, like, watch the whole, all thing. Of it. I could binge it now and probably watch all of it, but I've seen that lately they've been talking about how, you know, it didn't end. It kind of gives you the impression that Sam never got to go home.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they throw a title card up at the last thing, and it was like really hastily thrown together. Like it was so thrown together, they misspelled his name in the title card.
Okay.
So yeah, they're talking about rebooting it, and there's a contingent of fans who like they don't want the show to come back if the original actors can't come back. And they can't, because, like, Dean Stockwell had a stroke 5 years ago, and, like he's very private, but reportedly, like, he's lost all of his memories of ever having been an actor. So it's like, he can't come back. So it's, but yeah.
Yeah. They have to, you know what they, I mean, oddly enough, what's funny is that with the tech now, if they spent enough money, they could piece it together and recreate his character, you know, through CGI.
Yeah. Sure,
And and just recreate him. They could, you know, computerize him.
Right.
And it'd be weird, but they could do it because he was always a little fuzzy to look at anyway. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you could keep it that way if you rebooted. But, and besides, you could also make it so that he wasn't Dean Stockwell anyway. You know what I mean? That all of a sudden now he's got a new persona, but it's the same guy. You know, same person with all the same memories.
I guess, yeah. There's a
lot of way to work around that if you really wanted to. But I don't know that you really want to. I mean,
I'd
love Scott to come back and actually recreate and be the main character. He's the only one that would be really necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No one else would really be necessary. So, yeah. But I don't know. That's just me.
Yeah.
I am a sci-fi geek fan.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. Awesome.
It's funny because you mentioned that, and we oftentimes, just because being sci-fi geeks ourselves, we'll talk a little bit about other actors who have guested on Quantum Leap that have also done work on Star Trek. And so you did a couple episodes of Voyager. We were talking about that before we had the chance to ring you. And you got to originate the role of Seven of Nine's father, basically.
Yeah. It's funny because it was one episode, but it got split into two. I inadvertently did two episodes.
Yeah.
So, it is interesting to be listed as the guy, you know, because it's such a flashback, quick sort of thing.
Right.
You didn't really get a chance to do a whole lot of, you know, it wasn't like it's not like playing Sarek, you know what I mean?
Sure.
You're just a memory, which is interesting. I had a friend of mine ask me, you know, hey, since she's going to be on Picard, are we going to get to see you again?
That's exactly what Dennis said, actually, like, when we were talking about before. It's like, I wonder.
Have they been in touch about...
I mean, don't hold your breath, I don't think.
I gotcha. I mean, actually, not to spoil it, like, I just saw the episode that she was in, and I really got the impression, like, it's a one-off thing. Like, they brought her back for one episode, and now she's off doing her thing again. And,
Yeah. It's a fan pleaser, which is cool, you know, and that's all right. But I mean, she was, we've been friends on Twitter for a while, and I remember, you know, responding to that. She was very nervous about it, you know, like, what the hell, what are we going to talk about?
Yeah. Funny because I saw that, I read that in an interview with her recently, and I was kind of surprised because I feel like by the end of the show, especially, she had created such a wonderful character that was one of the stronger parts of the show. But I can only imagine what it would be like to go back to something 20 years later and have to try to, like, you know, recreate some of that magic, maybe.
I think it's amazing that she did and that the writers gave her the opportunity to create such an incredible role in the midst of such a hedonistic, misogynistic sort of still industry that, you know, pushed so hard for this idea of making her look practically nude throughout the entire thing, you know, and that thing bothered me to an extreme degree that all, you know, it was all about the action figure, you know, that somebody was going to be able to hold on to that looked like Lara Croft, you know, I mean, it's too bad in a sense that they had to go that route and that she had to deal with that. But in the midst of all of that, like I said, she rose above it. She created an incredible character. She dealt with a lot of that with grace, you know, and pushed forward because it's still there to a certain extent in a lot of sci-fi. But it, you know, I mean, it's getting better. And with Discovery, you know, things have changed a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's that's just something I've become much more sensitive to, even though I was at the time, too, kind of irritated and bugged about it. But another issue altogether.
I completely agree with you. I'm so glad that you said that. It's undoubtedly true, and I agree that she definitely rose above and continued to, you know, she had that guest spot on Boston Legal, where they even kind of poked a little bit of fun at the fact that she was supposed to be this femme fatale character, and ended up being able to kind of, you know, to play everybody and, you know, be the smarter one in the room, which was really great. So, I love that. That's fantastic. So I guess to kind of dive into talking a little bit about Quantum Leap,
How did you get the role in the episode Nowhere to Run?
It was just an audition that I got sent on a regular basis. I would head over to that studio, you know, and audition for, I think that was a Belisarius situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I did Nightman too. I did an episode of Nightman, which was a goofy show.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, he was doing his thing. I, you know, what originally I kind of got into that genre, that kind of push for a lot of auditions like that because of the earlier roles that I had. And you know what was interesting? It kind of came in a flurry. I went and I auditioned for this pilot called The Owl.
Okay.
Which was with Adrian Paul. And Adrian and I both auditioned for the lead in that. He got the lead. I ended up not getting the lead, but then getting cast as one of the bad guys. So he and I worked on the pilot. Thankfully, it didn't get picked up because it was trying to work off of the popularity of The Crow.
Mm. Oh my God! All right,
yeah. So what it did is it had him running around as the owl, and he would say "hoot hoot dirtbag" and stuff like that.
Oh man!
Throw out daggers from this cloak that he had that had owl heads on them. You know, it was really goofy, but that kind of led to a string of other auditions for things like, you know, Nightman and then also Quantum Leap. I had two auditions for Quantum Leap that didn't go through, and then I ended up getting this one.
Okay.
Do you remember what the other two auditions were for? Episodes or general, like, idea of, like, what the roles were?
I really actually don't.
No, that's fair. It's been, like, 28 years at this point, yeah.
You know what? A lot of times they were look-sees where it was like...
Oh, sure, yeah.
You went in and you weren't sure exactly what they were going to want. You know, there may not have been a side to read, something like that. But this was interesting. I liked this because it didn't even have that much dialogue at all. It's just a moment that is kind of nice in terms of realization.
Sure. Totally. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I family members who had been to NAMM and everything, that kind of, it kind of stuck with me. So I liked it, even though that wig was so freaking huge. But, you know.
No, it was a little, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that I really loved about the scene, and I don't know, this might kind of play into what you were just talking about, is that it would have been very, very easy to write the scene as the hippie coming up to Sam and, you know, calling him a baby killer or whatever. But instead, there's a lot of compassion in the moment, and the fact that you leave him with the piece, you know, so I really like that aspect of it. Quite a lot.
That's exactly what attracted me was that you're right. It would have been such an easy slide to show some protesting, you know, anti-war sentiment, and what's interesting about the scene and about honoring someone who had sacrificed, it doesn't mean that you're pro-war. It doesn't mean that you're happy about what he did or what he was or what he became the foil for. You understand the human side of it, and you recognize the connection at that point. And it's not to belabor it, but yeah, it's one of those small moments of humanity that it's great for us to all recognize. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
even in
sure.
the goofiest stories, you want to look at those things. I mean, please, you can watch Galaxy Quest and cry if you're looking for the right, you know.
yeah.
If you're that kind of person. And I love it when these, you know, self-professed sci-fi geeks, you know, do get emotional about certain things and talk about certain things, because what we've done is we've recognized humanity in even the most fantastical of moments. And that's the best. And if we can do that, then think how easy it is just to see it in mundane life. You know what I mean? If you can see it in the midst of Mordor, you know,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
you can get touched and enthralled by the fact that there's some kind of connection between humans or connection between entities, people, feelings, you know, it's important. It's highly important. So, yeah, and that's one of the things I did like about that show overall, you know. I mean, I liked the fact that he was being put in other people's shoes constantly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly being put in other people's shoes. Imagine if there'd been some Shane Black sort of backstory to Scott's character, to Sam.
Yeah.
That showed that he was a racist, that he was a hedonist, you know, that he was, you know what I mean? That he was this very, very, very corrupted human being.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they're forced to do this.
Yeah.
Right? And then it's kind of like, do you remember the Twilight Zone movie with Vic Morrow's character, okay, which was sadly ended in his death, actually, when, you know, Hughes decided to use choppers, which was
so stupid. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah.
But his character, you know, who was just such a jerk and a racist at the bar, and he ends up walking out of the bar and he gets thrown on a train like a Jew, and then, you know.
Yeah.
And then he's running from dogs like a runaway slave, or, you know what I mean? And then he's running through the jungle like, you know what I mean? So it's forced to live in the shoes of somebody else.
Sure. Yeah.
And learn. So. Yeah, I dug that a lot about that show, actually. And besides the fact, too, it was just anything fantastical in the 80s we all watched.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's great, too, because that particular period of time, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, you know, and even into the rest of the 90s was such a great time for, you know, sort of sci-fi and fantasy on television. And you had, you know, obviously like something like Star Trek Next Generation, but Twilight Zone had the reboot. You had Quantum Leap. You'd get shows like Babylon 5, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, The X-Files, etc., which you did an episode of Babylon 5.
In the 90s, you had that... Legend of the Seeker, you know, and, you know, wow. stuff like that.
Right.
A little bit more money was being spent in terms of effects, you know. And,
well, even like Highlander and Hercules and Xena and shows like that as well, which were, you know, co-productions between, like, U.S. companies and
right.
companies overseas and stuff. And you had a little bit more investment behind them. And I think syndication helped that a lot. I mean, these days, you don't really get... I mean, streaming services have kind of filled that niche in some ways, but not quite the same, because there's a little bit more proprietary sense of it. It's like, this is our show, whereas with syndication, it was more about, you know, the producers who were making the show.
It's become so much more corporate now anyway, you know, but
yeah.
And yet, I mean, in the light of any time a bubble starts to grow where elitism and corporatism gets bigger, there's this opportunity for independence to shine, you know? I mean, there's always, it sparks independent work again.
Yeah.
It's so funny because that was common in the 80s. We were so sick of formulaic blockbuster movies that art films became so popular. We started all going to independent art houses to see things like Mona Lisa and Kiss the Spider-Woman and, you know, you know what I mean? It was like, wow, these are where the real movies are being made. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, you'd occasionally go, wow, Die Hard was so cool, you know?
Yeah, sure.
So cool. But then for the most part, you know, what the hell? What's going on, you know? So it's an interesting cycle that ends up happening.
Yeah.
You know, what's funny is I look back on that episode, I rewatched that episode, and I'd forgotten that I stood around hanging and talking with Jennifer Aniston and didn't even...
Oh, really?
You know, because she hadn't become Rachel yet.
Right.
You know?
This was like 2 years before, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had no idea. She was just an actress. She was just a nice girl to stand around and talk to at craft service. You know
right.
what I mean?
Sure, sure.
I gotcha. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's weird when that happens. I mean, you know, with Brad and I, you know, bounced off each other all the time at different auditions, and we'd done a movie together, so it was no big, you know, as he became a huge superstar, that was, you know, I mean, you recognize that, like, if you saw him in a couple later at an audition or something, you know, ooh, he's on the rise, you
yeah,
know, that kind
sure,
of thing.
Yeah.
But with meeting her, you know, like, it's like I did an episode of LA Dragnet, and, you know, Eva Longoria, you know, was on the show.
Oh, wow.
She,
yeah.
She interviews me with the other young actor who probably, I don't know if he's gone anywhere after that, but yeah, tiny little, she's like 5'4".
Yeah.
You know? And she's interviewing me and everything and that. And then she took off and, you know, became somebody bigger. Josh Brolin, I can remember sitting around with Brolin when he was 19 years old.
Wow.
At Fountain and Suites or in his apartment he was staying in during Young Riders. And he, you know, drinking and smoking and talking about how he didn't want to be compared to his dad. And he was concerned about you know, making his own way, and you know,
yeah,
and,
sure.
I think he succeeded.
I think he's gonna,
yeah, be fine, dude.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Now, locally here, you're somewhat active as an actor still locally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I still audition. I did an episode of Chicago PD.
I saw that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm filming a movie right now, actually. So
I saw that it was you had something coming up, but it looked like I didn't know if it was like already shot or what was going
no,
on.
No, we've got another week of shooting, and then we'll be done. So.
Is that,
oh, very cool.
Is that the on IMDb the listing Blackout? Is that the name of it?
Blackout.
Yeah,
yeah,
cool. Right on. Yeah,
and the script and the director actually worked quite a bit about 20 years ago independently. Artistically, but then got into educational work and started doing a lot of educational documentaries and instructional films and things like that. And he has written 4 or 5 scripts that he's working on at this point. He's got a feature that he's planning on going after later on after this, but he's got this short that he wanted to do. And it's a good way to, for I'm in the midst of trying to build up more and more current reel.
Mm-hmm. I got you.
Footage. So that's the thing. I've done a couple of short films that are still in the can right now, and you know we'll see what I can pull from it. One that's really interesting. It's on IMDb too. That's also it's by a director called Zach Cortino. I've done 2 shows with him actually. The first one was a very bizarre sci-fi script that was a really sort of quick pastiche kind of put together thing that almost seems like student. It's very student.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Name kind of.
Yeah.
And partly because the concept is there, the acting isn't. You know what I mean? You've almost got real people brought in to sort of dryly do lines, and that always shows this. You know, it always gives you this feeling of, oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
They paid them $5 and a candy bar. You know what I mean?
So, yeah.
But still, you look at I've been always that kind of person who's looked at concept overall. You know, I mean, like, is this a good pitchable concept? Could this turn into something bigger?
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And that happens a lot with the festivals. A lot of those shorts, 15-minute shorts that go to the festivals are really actually advertisements for the idea of, hey, I could do a bigger film.
Right.
Oh,
doing.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Blackout is like that. It is it's a short little piece that I don't know if he'll hit the festival circuit or if he'll hang on to it for a little bit or what. I'm not sure certain about it, but it's an interesting concept.
Yeah.
Like it's a family dynamic under stress, and it's an interesting thing, you know, to look at. He did a short film that I got to see. I liked looking at what directors do prior to getting in. You know, if they've got anything, you'd naturally do that, right? You go back and look at for their previous work, you know,
totally.
What I mean? Mm-hmm. If you can. And he did a short thing called The Sanctuary, which was incredible in terms of visuals. He's really good. He's got a great eye.
Mm-hmm.
Very short on dialogue, but big on subcontent in terms of trying to figure out what's going on. You know what I mean? What's the gag? What's going, you know, where's the real story?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's there. You can tell there's something going on that he's sort of almost underwritten that he wants you to guess at. And that's an interesting way of going about it as a director. That's not Iñárritu. That's not Guillermo del Toro. You know what I mean? That's almost, and it's not, and he's not Wes Anderson. You know what I mean? It's not I made a decision and this is my quirky take on, or this is my, you know, this is my image of,
right.
This is what I've decided this story is. It's more like, here's an impression of a concept, and I'm going to leave it to you, the audience, to kind of get what you get out of these images and these moments.
Yeah, sure.
So that's, I don't know if you guys are into, more like esoteric sci-fi.
Yeah.
That is much more thought provocative.
Oh, sure.
You know,
yeah.
When people saw Arrival,
yes,
there were a lot of people like, what happened?
Yeah.
Like, or people have walked out of the movie theater going, yeah, so,
I got you. Yeah.
Yeah. Why can't I think of the name of the film now? But there's a, it's a film with Jake Gyllenhaal actually. And it kind of reminds me what you're saying about that, or even like, why can't I think of the name of it now?
Was that the one where he was the reporter?
No, although that's another one that's really, really good. This one is, I'll get there.
It's okay. Sorry.
But,
not Source Code.
No, not Source Code. Not Source Code. Not Nightcrawler. Oh yeah, it was, okay, it was. It's a Denis Villeneuve film called Enemy. And he also is the same director that did Blade Runner 2049. And I feel like he's very much along the lines of what you're talking about, where Enemy in particular is a movie where he really, you know, he presents something to you as an audience member and then lets you make of it what you will. While I appreciate some of the other filmmakers that you mentioned too, who are very much like, you know, here's my concept, here's the way I'm telling this story, here are these people, here, you know, here it is, giving it to you. There is something about someone who, instead of giving it to you, it kind of extends an invitation as a filmmaker, like, come with me, as opposed to, I'm giving you something.
Right, let's go look at this together.
Yeah, and I think with sci-fi or speculative fiction in general, that kind of invitation ends up being usually more powerful than when you try to just give somebody something. Which I wonder if that's some of the difficulty that maybe people are having with Star Trek Picard. I think for the majority, people are enjoying it, but you do read some of the detractors.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that they're with Star Trek, they're so used to having that, you know, sort of spoon fed to them, that Picard is doing a little bit less of that. And so they're struggling, I think, maybe to make sense of what's going on in some ways.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. No, it's an interesting thing. That's what I love about film anyway, is the trying to figure out the puzzle in a sense, you know, of how it's being presented to you and what's being presented to you, you know, is there entertainment in the didactic nature of it, or is it just simply trying to slam something at me in terms of a directorial mission of a statement of some sort? What's the statement being made? You know, that kind of thing is a defensive way of going in to watch a film. You know, going, okay, I know this is a very heavy subject, so I can't wait to see what the director's take on this is. You know, that's natural, I guess, but I don't know. Well, I always feel for the directors who take on projects that are that have huge fan bases and massive, massive amounts of preconceived opinion.
Sure,
you know. God forbid, I mean, God's bless, you know, any of the directors who take on any Batman movies, you know what
sure,
I mean?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
Come on, you know, and I got my fingers crossed for Pattinson, but I see those recent leaked photos. Ridiculous armor, motorcycle armor kind of, you know, Batman thing. I don't know, so I'm kind of...
We'll see. I do like the one aspect of it that I do really enjoy is that the bat symbol on the suit is made out of pieces of the gun that apparently killed his parents.
I mean, if the people who are going to get that are the, you know what I mean, the people
right.
who read into that, or unless they expose that in some way by showing you that that's what he's done when he creates the suit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So show the whole audience that this is what's important about that. Those are tidbits and Easter eggs that are so much fun for anybody who cares about the deepness of the story that we've heard a million times.
Right.
It's an old story. Come on. You know what I mean?
Sure, yeah.
It is still one of the best vigilante origin stories of all time, you know, but that's also why the suit is so important, because the idea of being inspired by fear to create a suit that will inspire fear.
Yeah.
Needs to mean, you know, there's a great short film called Batman Dead End.
Okay.
That was done by a guy named Sandy Calora, And it's on YouTube, and it's just this short little fan-made film, but he's in the industry, and all of the people he got involved are also industry professionals who had stock footage and costumes and all kinds of things, you know what I mean? So yeah. it's not a cheap little deal. It's well done. And it's just a little quick little funny concept, but it's not. It's done extremely seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who plays Batman in it, you see him suiting up in the beginning, and it is the absolute old-fashioned Dark Knight kind of, you know, idea with just a fairly muscular, well-built guy with a massive, almost leather-looking cloak and cowl.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When he pulls on and he's got his hands wrapped like a boxer, and then when he puts on the gloves, you can hear the squeak of the leather when he pulls them on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? When he flexes his fingers, he puts the belt on, you can see that all he has is a dark gray sort of suit that is just, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Form-fitting, but could be, you know, anything. And he's got the black bat across his, you know, shoulders. But when there's this incredible, I mean, his chest, when he, there's a great shot when he drops from a height and the points of the cape spread out on the ground when he's crouching.
Mm-hmm.
And the music swells when you see him from overhead in the rain, and he stands up and the points all come together, and then it looks like he's standing there like a, you know, like a vulture sort of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
This slow move of just the come in, the points come in. It's that little moment that caught my eye and kept me watching. I was like, oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? And the next thing you know, he gets jumped by the Joker, who's in a straitjacket. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this kid, Andrew Koenig, plays the Joker, and it's way different from any Joker you've seen.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I love people embracing it and taking it in one direction or the other, but keep, you know, go back to keeping it, this is a troubled person.
Right.
Sure. Yeah.
Who is in this suit, you know?
Yeah.
He's a troubled guy. He's dealing with some major, major issues.
Yeah. And
he really should be seeing a therapist.
Sure. You know?
Yeah. Maybe he is. That's the other thing. I really think that would be great to see a Batman movie where you see Bruce Wayne going to see a therapist on a regular basis.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then a moment when he's actually, you hear him talking on the phone with his therapist, and then when you open up the shot, you see that he's still in his bat suit. He's on. He's next to some gargoyle up on a building, and he's in a sort of fetal position, sitting there with the cape wrapped around him, and he has to be talking.
Yeah,
yeah.
To somebody, he just went through something that reminded him of something that made him, you know, and he doesn't tell the therapist, you know, my job. He doesn't tell him what he's doing, but, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, it makes it difficult to do my job, you know, when this happens, and it makes it difficult for me to do my job.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I would love to see that.
The therapist is half asleep, you know, putting light on, turning the bedside light on, you know, going, you know, well, Bruce, I understand that, but, you know.
Right. Well, it's like, it reminds me a little bit of The Sopranos and the idea that, like, you know, Tony.
Yes, with Lorraine, yeah, Bracco, yeah.
Yeah.
It could be that, and it should be that.
Yeah.
I mean, these fantastical characters that decide to do things that normal humans don't decide to do have to have accountability and cost.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I'm a huge fan of that. I'm a huge fan of, you know, the fact that Indiana Jones hits somebody and then his hand hurts.
Yes.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's a trend that started back in that day and got better and better and better. This idea of a faulted hero. You know,
yeah.
My favorite line in Raiders of the Lost Ark is, you know, what now, Indy? I don't know. I'm making this up as I go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yep.
that kind of thing is important to me, and I love that. It really shows that. I think that shows more hero than anything else is somebody who's, I'm diving in because I think it's the right thing to do. I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm going to do it.
Right.
You know.
I think that's one of the things that Zack Snyder comes very close to getting right in a movie like Batman vs. Superman, where he...
Then he glitzes up and messes up the art direction.
Exactly. Yep.
The art direction kills those movies for me.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That overwash tone and then glitz in the wrong places and too much sparkle here and there. And, you know, I mean, come on.
Well,
get down to the gritty reality of the fact that some things are brighter colored and some things aren't. And something, you know.
Yeah.
And something that I could reach out and touch, not something that looks like a page off of a comic book. I get it that it's a comic.
Right.
But I'm sorry, I'm a little bit ranty about that kind of stuff. So.
No, I completely agree with you. Because, like, for me, one of the things, and it's in the Ultimate Edition of Batman vs. Superman, it's not in the theatrical cut, which is unfortunate, is that he spends a lot of time with Clark and doing some investigative reporting. And it's really this wonderful... display of what Superman has to do in his alter ego and the investment that he has in that and also how it begins to merge and conflict with him as Superman and what, you know, is he trying to influence people and how they view Superman as Clark Kent and vice versa. And it's, there's some really interesting stuff, but it's one of those things where he doesn't go far enough because he'd rather have a 25-minute battle with this CGI doomsday creature that we don't need.
Yeah. You can pull your favorite moments from that. You know, the Wonder Woman stuff is all the best stuff.
Totally. Yeah.
You know, and their reaction to who she is, and then that awesome theme that she has.
Yeah.
You know, That kind of thing, you know, it gets exciting when you see that happening, you know, because she shows up and she's got purpose.
Right.
She's got, you can tell, she's, you know, this is what I do and this is what I need to do. You know what I mean? And it's just, that's awesome, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I really pushed for Affleck to be a great, I wanted it to be good, you know?
Right.
I like the suit. I do like the suit.
Yeah. Well, because I think that suit was more along the lines of what you're talking about. That suit had potential to be scary, whereas, you know, other suits that we've seen, including the newest one, doesn't feel quite as scary.
I mean, Affleck's Batman was Frank Miller, you know? That's where it came, you know, from. Because he's the older Bruce at that point, you know what I mean? That's cool. I'm still... It still surprises me that I'm more of a Keaton fan than anybody else. You know, we were scared to death when he got cast. You know what I mean?
Sure, like, yeah.
All my comic book buddies, all my actors from the Shakespeare troupe, all my friends from college, you know, who are all like, you know, Batman movie. There's going to be a Batman movie. What?
Yeah.
What? Mr. Mom? What?
It's funny, too, because I recently went back and watched the first two, and I think I almost prefer Batman Returns to Batman. Yeah. Like, I think so good.
Yeah. Oh, that's I'm not a huge fan of the first one. You know, it's goofy, and I never liked Nicholson, you know, but I like moments that he created, and I like some of the concepts that they had behind it, but there was Burton's stuff. It really, really is cartoon, you know.
Yeah,
that's okay. I gotta plug in because my phone's about to die.
Oh no, no, no worries. We shouldn't keep you too much longer anyway. I do want to actually take it back to Quantum Leap real quick, and because
sorry about that.
No. This has been lovely.
You have not listened to our podcast.
we go on lots of tangents.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I did want to ask is you kind of mentioned something along these lines earlier, but when you're dealing with something that is heavy, and this episode deals with Vietnam and disabled veterans and PTSD, and coming into it and having the role that you had and the way that they sort of set up the bar to, you know, to the point where, you know, Scott's character, his wife even asks him, like, are you sure you want this place? Can you talk a little bit about the setting and even, you know, your opinions on the choice to have them go to this bar where, you know, there's a singer on stage singing Eve of Destruction and Blowing in the Wind and people are, you know, in that spirit of 68 free love hippie garb, including your character, as opposed to having them go to you know, a fancy restaurant or some, you know,
yeah,
army safe, bar or whatever. Yeah.
Some safe conservative, you know, possibly almost war hawkish, you know, sure. Military yeah. thing, you know.
Exactly.
You know, I didn't put a whole lot of thought into it at the time, other than that it seemed an interesting choice. This idea of, again, it fell right into line with this idea of putting, you had the same thing happening to, or being self-imposed, because the character, Sam's character chooses, well, I mean, he is Sam at the time, but I mean, what's interesting is you wonder if the guy himself, if Sam was not in his body.
Yeah, sure.
You know what I mean? Would have rebuffed the idea of going into that place.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But Sam goes, you know what I mean? He yeah. decides, yeah, this is good. Let's go here. Right. So he's okay with that. She's sensitive to it because, you know, who knows where she was during the whole conflict. You know, who knows if she's sat while he was overseas, you know, defending the government's ideology, you know, and being there. I'd have to go back and look at more of if there was more backstory to that. I haven't seen that episode in a little while, but, for me, being in that setting, it kind of made perfect sense that we would all be there, because obviously with the girl on the stage, with the way the design of the place, and it's obviously not too far down the realm of the whole flower power thing, which is just kind of, sure. you know, I mean, the Brady Bunch hippie is the thing you want to avoid when you start talking about anti-war sentiment.
Right.
You know, would that happen to me when I was doing hair in 1988 here in Chicago?
Yeah.
I was the lead in that. So, but the way they handled it, even though it was the original producer, Michael Butler, from the, you know, from the original production in 69, the way the 1988 tribe got handled was extremely, surface and flower sure. power, you know, goofy hippie laugh-in, you know, that kind of thing. Rowan and Martin's laugh-in.
Yeah.
Which made it really hard when you're trying to push the let's make love, not war, you know, sentiment, you know. So I did notice that. I did feel good about the choice, you know, but it also made sense to me that what it was doing was it was putting people in situations that created conflict. And that's why, like we said earlier, I did like the choice that my character was directed and also written as being somebody who didn't walk up to him and give him a hard time. He saw what he'd done, and that stops everything.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
And then my character's recognition of that is, wow.
Well, and I think one of the interesting things too is that your character is the only, you know, example that we get of someone who is just sort of, you know, man on the street, if you will, reacting to the shoes that Sam is in, if you will, because
yeah,
everything else we've seen.
It would have been really interesting had there been two different encounters, you know what I mean? Where there'd been somebody who had started coming over to the table, you know, going, hey, what are you doing in here, man? You baby killer, you know, and then my character walking over and going, hey, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Let me buy you a beer.
But it wasn't about that at all. It was about a quick exchange, you know, just to highlight the fact that there was at least one person that, you know, was not what you would have expected.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Now, so for our listeners, real quick, because I mean, Dennis and I have in previous lives and times been actors ourselves and worked on sets. But for a role like this, can you just describe some of the process and sort of, you know, your day on the set and et cetera, and what shooting was like on this show specifically?
Again, there was a lot of hurry up and wait on this one, because, you know, which is okay. I personally, that's fine with me. I love downtime. I love being able to be in different situations where I can actually experience it, you know, overall. And there's nothing worse than like being rushed in doing something and getting out.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah.
If you are the kind of person who likes being part of the group that is creating. You know, if it's this gypsy caravan, you know, that is filming something, and then you just get to visit for 5 minutes and leave, then that's no fun.
Yeah, you
know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I've always viewed it. I love those longer shoots. I've done 4 week and 18 week shoots, you know, kind of things where you go off and you get to know the crew really well, and you get to know the area that you're in, and you're all doing the same thing together and fighting to make this thing happen. And,
yeah.
You know, that's a fun thing.
Yeah.
That's what we live for, you know, in terms of doing film and television, but, not so much theater, even though that's a different thing. You create an ensemble that you all go through something together, and then you all live, but you're all kind of going every night, you're going home, you know what I mean?
Right. So,
this was fun because it did take the whole day, and that was nice. And it was fun because it did go by pretty quickly, but you know, got there, went to makeup, went to, you know, did wardrobe, walked around in that for a while, went to craft service. Like I said, hung out and talked to Jennifer Aniston for about an hour, you know, and, you know, couldn't help sitting there thinking, you know, I might ask this girl out.
Oh, yeah. You know? I wouldn't blame you one bit.
No, yeah.
Yeah. Life would have been way different.
Yeah.
But I did.
There you go.
Yeah. So, but anyway, and I was involved anyway, so it was that kind of situation, and then you just get called to set, and if you've ever done that, you know that can take a while too, because first team goes in, they check camera angles, and then they step out, and then they line up the shots, and they figure out the gaffer walks around, and they look, and they're setting flags, they're doing whatever they can, they want to get the right look. They're going to set up one angle, and then they go and they shoot that. You might even be off camera, and then you go in and they do it again, and then they come back on you, turn it around, new deal, set up, first team come in, set it up, get the look, step out, second team step in, stand there, and then get all the measurements done, and then you wait, and you go and you know, have a cup of coffee, do whatever, you know, and then next thing you know, and a lot of times, instead of stepping away, I would just go off into the fringes, get out of everybody's way, and I wanted to watch the process, you know.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I wanted to see the dolly grip, I wanted to see the gaffer, I wanted to see the juicers, and doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
And then I did grip and I did juice for a while. I did that on a couple of films. And that was fun because Rick Schroeder actually was producer on something, called me up one day and said, "Do you want a grip job?" And I was like, yeah. Sweet. So I went off and did that, you know?
Yeah.
So if you're running cables, you're, you know, humping around with C stands and sandbags, you know, and apple boxes, you know, you're part of the group. You're doing it.
Right.
I just love making magic. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, holding a flag in a rainstorm to make sure that the bounce is right. You know what I mean?
Oh, I got you. Yeah.
In the wind.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Wearing all full rain gear and everything. That was fun. So then, yeah, you get the shot done, and you know, that's a wrap. I'm David.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Shake Scott's hand, you know, and everything. He stands up and gives me a hug, you know, which is nice. You know,
yeah.
Took a photo with me and that kind of thing, the Polaroid, which I don't know where the hell that went. But
that ended up, sure, yeah.
You know.
We've talked a lot and about Scott, and it's all been based off of interviews or things that we've read, but obviously his workload on the show was pretty gigantic compared to a lot of other actors, you know, on TV and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But we always hear about how great spirits he was in, how generous he is, how, you know, how warm he is. So it's interesting to hear that you said he gave you a hug, but any other memories that kind of stand out about him at all or working with him?
You know, just that feeling of, I did get that. He was not in any way diva-ish. He was not somebody who felt like he acted with such humility, in a sense that he seemed like the kind of guy who felt just really happy to be doing what he was doing and didn't feel like he just totally deserved this and everything was, you know, and this was his show now.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
And he still deferred to, the director and to the producers and that kind of thing. Like, you know, what do you think? Was that, how did this work? Blah, 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 blah. He was totally like, obviously it's a familiar thing. He's the star, you know, I mean, it's, he can easily go, you know, can we do that again or whatever, you know, or can we try that again?
Sure.
I remember working with Stallone in my first film, actually, and getting an interesting glimpse of an actor director, an actor director who really frames things. He's got his idea of how things should look.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's deferring to the director, but he's really kind of guiding that director.
Sure. You know, yeah. Yeah.
In close indoor shots, not so much outside, but like if you watch, like there's a great documentary about lockup, you know, mm-hmm. where they're at Rahway, you know, just outside in the yard, and it's snowing like crazy, but they're out there and they're rolling around in the mud, and it's just, you know, he and Sonny Landham are coordinating a fight just on the cuff. He's showing Sonny how to hook his leg and throw him back, and you know that, you know what I mean? Things like that are a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah.
Coordinator, because he coordinated that whole thing.
Wow, wow.
He's a maniac. I loved working with Sly.
Yeah.
But he, in those close quarters, John Flynn was directing, but John would shoot it. We'd run it. Sly would get up and run over and look at it and watch it come back, and he'd go, "No, let's do that again." You know. Mm. And then he'd walk over and we'd do it again, and he'd come back and go, "That's the money shot. Okay, print it. That's the money. Do it.
Yeah.
Move it up." You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I got you. Yeah.
He had it in his head in terms of how that should look, you know, and that, and what was really amazing to me was that I was nobody. I was nobody.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was nice enough and magnanimous enough to go, you know, what do you think about this shot? You know,
wow.
Where should we go on this? Or, you know, how do you feel about this? Like when we're in, he's in the jail cell and I come up in the wheelchair, you know, that kind of thing. He's like, yeah, I'm going to be way at the, and I'll be right here. And I said, I think it's probably good if you are, you know, you don't approach the bars right away.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And he's like, yeah, because I don't know who the hell you are. So maybe I shouldn't be right here to greet you at the bars. You know, and he said, yeah, you know, you want to test me before you get too close, right? You know,
I got you, yeah.
Is what you do, shiv me through the bars.
Yeah. I mean, that's a hallmark,
you
though.
You never know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's always a hallmark of a great artist, though, is that, especially when it comes to film, television, or theater, is that spirit of collaboration. The idea that everybody's opinion matters and everybody's input counts. And that's really cool to hear about him. It's funny, when I was a kid, I remember catching that movie late at night on HBO, you know, staying up far later and watching channels I shouldn't have, and just kind of fell in love with it for whatever reason, and so it's a movie that I've actually seen quite a few times.
Yeah, it's in my reel. It's something that I do the throwback Thursdays on, you know, and everything, because it was a fun role.
Yeah,
and you know, it lives in forever now as this nice moment in Stallone's history too. You know what I mean? It's that hallmark of a guy who is moving past this legacy of Rocky, you know what I mean, and Rambo.
Sure. Yeah.
But he was in the midst of Rambo because he was training to do Rambo 2 at that point.
Oh, wow.
Oh, really? Okay.
So he was yoked, but he was not like cut like, he, you know, yet.
Yeah.
You know,
he was
eating like crazy.
Yeah.
We'd sit in his trailer. That's the other thing. He was like, yeah, come on in. You can have lunch, you know, blah, 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 blah. We'd sit, so we'll talk, you know, that kind of thing. And when hanging with him and just, you know, eating, and he had like two or three Cornish game hens and a bunch of, you know, wild rice and a whole bunch of vegetables. And then, you know, I just, eating like crazy. But I don't know. I was reading an article earlier this morning about what all the training that went into Predator 2 and those guys. They'd get up at 3 in the morning, actually, to go for a 12-hour shoot. They would go train first.
Wow.
And then come in, because if you watch Predator, this guy makes a comment on the fact that all the more modern action heroes are a combination of either this slimmed-down look or these, you know, somewhat muscled here and there, or water pills or that kind of thing, or personal trainers, you know, so that they can look somewhat good for these movies. You have not seen big muscle men in these movies much anymore.
Right.
You know, back in the 80s in Predator, every guy in that movie is massive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Except for Shane Black, who hustled his way into playing a character.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, so, but if you look at, I mean, Carl Weathers.
That's who I was thinking of, too. Yeah.
Just arms. Arnold tricked Jesse Ventura. I love his, he's a prankster. He's a complete prankster, you know, and he messes with people's heads. He did that with Lou Ferrigno. If you've ever seen Pumping Iron.
Yeah.
Arnold was cruel. He was not nice to Lou, you know what I mean? But it was all in this idea of messing with his head, you know. It's a competitive thing.
Right.
He knows how to do that. He told the wardrobe people to tell Jesse Ventura that Jesse's arms were bigger than Arnold's, you know. They showed him some wardrobe, you know, that was supposed to fit Arnold, and it was like, wow, I can't even get my arm in that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, like, see, your arms are like at least an inch bigger than Arnold's, you know?
He
was touting that, and then he goes and he tells Arnold, you know, about that, and Arnold's like, yeah, well, let's go to the gym and work out, you know, that we should work out together, because I want to get as big as you. You know, and then they're working, and Arnold's, you know, flexing and going, you know, maybe we should check, you know, and Arnold, they check, and Arnold's like 3 inches bigger than Jesse, you know, because he'd fooled him, you know. Crazy,
right?
Not something I ever pushed for, you know.
Yeah, well, it is interesting because I feel like we've, you know, now we've got somebody like Dwayne Johnson, who you know is probably one of the few people that
trains all the time.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's insane.
And Jason Momoa, you know, yep. I mean those guys are big dudes. You know? I mean, so yeah, you see it, but you don't see. You don't see a lot of those. I mean, you don't just don't see movies like that much anymore.
No.
I mean, it is interesting though, and that's okay because it has its place in time. Wolverine, though, I mean, that's the thing. It's you know, Jackman did get pretty jacked. But he was. I mean, the whole thing messed with my head anyway because Wolverine's supposed to be 5'4" anyway, or 5'5".
Right.
Know, So it the whole thing I kind of threw off anyway. Oh yeah, he looks great.
Sure. Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good for him. Hey.
So, you know, we actually probably should have started with something like this, but I am curious. You know, just briefly, how did you get your start?
How did I get what?
How did you get your start? Like where? Like what was your background? You know.
Wow. I moved to Chicago out of Illinois State University's theater department.
Okay.
And with a bunch of people from ISU, jumped into creating a theater company called Famous Door.
Okay.
And that's that's what I was cultivating. Yes, this idea of being a theater actor. I want, you know, like the Circle and the Square, or the Goodman Theater, or something like that. I really wanted to. Do stage. I came and I did Shakespeare in Chicago. I did the opening debut of a play called Black and Blue with the Famous Door. Got a great review from Richard Christensen back at that point in time. That was maybe 86, 87. And then did theater around the city. And that's what I was really thinking was my path. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to do. I loved film and I wanted to do film really badly, but I didn't know exactly how that was going to be possible unless I got myself to a point where I really felt confident enough to maybe just head out to LA.
Sure. Yeah.
And then I saw that there was a general audition I went and I auditioned at Shakespeare with Steppenwolf, and I did a couple, you know, with Gary Cole, and that was a lot of fun. And, you know, and then with the Shakespeare repertory with Barbara Gaines, did that. I was a fight coordinator and, you know, really was pushing for all of that. Worked with David Woolley and Bruce Young and those guys and the swordsmen. So really was focusing on that. My girlfriend and I lived together and we were both from ISU and she was acting as well. And then next thing I knew, there was an open audition for the revival of, and from the original producer of Hair at the Big Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I auditioned for that to be Claude because I'd done that in college. They cast me as Berger, the lead. So I all of a sudden had an opportunity to be in a union show.
Yeah.
Sure. And then I became union and I didn't know what to do about that. So I had a friend's agent who at the time was here, Elizabeth Geddes. Mm-hmm. She negotiated my contract for me so that I knew, you know, I wasn't getting screwed.
Yeah. Sure.
And then she came to see the show, and she came backstage and asked if I wanted to be represented.
Oh, wow.
And I said, sure. So now I had an agent. And I was also AEA. I was now Actors Equity.
Yeah.
Not yet SAG. But then she sent me around the city for a little while to during a strike for AFTRA, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I did a Bullseye Barbecue commercial. I did a McDonald's commercial that just got session rates because I basically was scabbing, you know. So
sure, yeah.
I was a young actor, 25, you know, didn't, you know, yeah, send me someplace to do something cool. So I got some voiceover experience, which was fun to be in a studio doing that. And then, let's see, what it ends wise. Oh, well, then Yvonne Suhor, who was lost in the last couple of years, unfortunately, was a friend of mine from college, and she was in L.A. on an ABC holding contract.
Okay.
Then she calls me up at my place and says, listen, they're auditioning right now for the lead in this thing called The Kid. Okay.
Okay.
And it's a Western that I've been cast in as a girl who dresses as a boy to ride in the Pony Express.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, that's cool. That's interesting. And she said, they're looking for the lead. And I said, it's television. Yvonne, I don't want to do television.
Yeah.
You know, most of television was like Fantasy Island and, you know, whatever. I didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, you don't understand. It's a Western and it's being shot on film.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. All right. And I ride horses. So, yeah, sure. Uh-huh. I think I'll think about that. That's cool. She goes, go to your new agent and ask her to send an audition. And I was like, all right. So I went to Elizabeth, and she said, well, they're looking for, like, a 17-year-old kid. You're 25,
uh-huh.
You know.
Yeah.
So she said, but, I mean, if you want to. I said, yeah, let's just do it. And I was clean-shaven, and I was mm-hmm. pretty damn young. I, you know, in fact, I pulled this out. That was me. At the time.
Yeah.
So shaved and put the hair back, you know, and put on a cowboy hat and
mm-hmm.
sent the audition, and they immediately responded with first class tickets to come out to Century City.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, wow. Cool.
And she looked at me and said, if you ever ask me to send another video, I will do it without asking. And I said, no, that's great. It's just the luck of the draw. But, you know, I mean, whenever somebody says, oh, it's all luck, it's like, yeah, you know what, though? It's luck that the door opens. It's not luck that you win. You know,
sure. Totally.
It's you're either what they're looking for or they're not, but you also have to do a good job.
Right.
You know, you can't fold. You've got to get in and do it. So there's a certain level of luck and a certain level of skill. So I have to believe that. You have to believe that. If you just think it's just all luck, then anybody could be anybody. And I get that. That's true too. That can happen, but that's not exactly how it works. So I felt good about the fact that I at least was kind of close to what they were thinking. But I also got out there thinking, it doesn't matter. If this doesn't happen, I'm just going to go back to Chicago and do theater.
Sure.
Sure.
Which later on I got told by an agent and from a casting director, I think it's that sense of the fact that he didn't really care that we all loved, because it really showed his sort of confidence. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Like, whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, because then I go out and I audition, and they said, yeah, Lynn Lurie at MGM, she said, yeah, that was good, but it's a 5-year contract and you're supposed to be about 16 and you're going to age.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to work and everything, but thanks so much. And there are other things auditioning in the building. So if you stick around for a little while, I'll just, you know, shove you in, you know, if you want it. And I said, yeah, that's great. She was nice to meet you, you know, blah, 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 blah. And as I was leaving, this girl, Sharon Hall, who I found out was Monty Hall's daughter.
Oh, wow.
And she was cute, too. That's terrible. But it's true. She walks out and says, how did it go? And I said, well, yeah, I'm just a little too old for it. She goes, hang on a second, I have an idea. And she walked into Lynn. She comes back out. She goes, do you know the other role, the Hickok role? And I said, yeah, but I heard that Josh Brolin has that role already. And she said, yeah, but he looks younger than you. And if we get him to take the lead, you could be accepted as 19, 20 years old, 22 years old. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I went, oh, okay.
Okay, yeah.
So she said, can you prepare that for tomorrow? I said, I can do it right now. I know the scene. I just give me 5 minutes to kind of go over it. And then I went in and I auditioned for Lynn. She went, you know what? I'll buy that. That's fine. I'll send you to network tomorrow. So I signed a 20-10 contract and then went to network. And then ABC said, yes, let's cast him as long as Josh Brolin doesn't, you know, as long as Josh Brolin gives up the role and takes the lead.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I went back to the hotel and then they called and said, you know, Brolin's agent asked for even more money. He's keeping the role that he had. So we're still looking for the, you know, the thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I flew back with points, you know.
Sure.
At that point now I've got quotes, right? So, but I flew back to Chicago and then the very next day I get a call from Elizabeth saying, you're going back to California because they just cast you as the bad guy. And I went, what?
Yeah.
And they went, you're going to be Scarface and the bad guy. And I went, okay. I thought he was like 38 years old, you know, and they're like, they liked the look, they liked your face. They like, you know, it's all about the sure. face, Dan, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. Yeah. So she goes, you're going to cowboy camp in Sonora, California.
Oh, you know, man.
I was like, okay, sweet. So then that was a lot of fun. And I met some great wranglers and met some really cool people, got some great stories. I love cowboy history, mm-hmm. you know? It was a blast and, hung out and had dinner with some of the people in Jamestown, which is an old, you know, tribute sort of Western town where mm-hmm. people walk around that work there every day, you know, that dressed in period clothing and they, you know, it's just and the shops are filled with things that you get in, you know, 1875, 1880, you know, and it's just cool.
Yeah.
It's really cool. But he and this guy named Larry Hawk Donovan, he played a scout, just a guy who was part of the atmosphere, you know mm. what I mean? And he and his wife invited me to come have dinner up in their place, which is up in sort of a Hawk Erie, you know?
Oh, wow.
And his back porch looks over this big, huge valley, and you can see the hawks dipping everywhere. And it's, you know, we just sat there and smoked pipes.
It was man.
I was like, Jesus.
That's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also when I really started smoking too a lot, and that sucked. But you know,
yeah,
because what happened is I thought it'd be cool to smoke those what are they called, backwoods smokes? They're just rolled tobacco, you know, like really skinny, something Clint Eastwood would smoke between his teeth.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And they were harsh as hell. It looked great, but they were harsh as hell.
Yeah.
So the prop guy throws me a carton of red Marlboros and he's like, here, that'll soften it.
Oh my God.
And then there's so much wait time, you know, you just sit there and all you're doing is you're, you know, eating, drinking water, smoking cigarettes, and you grab a bagel, smoke a cigarette.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So happily gave that up more than 20 years ago, but still. You know, it's nuts. It was an interesting thing. My mother died at 44 of cancer. You know, and then my aunt also died of cancer. And there's been lots of cancer in my family.
Yeah.
And I went off and, you know, smoked like crazy for a little while in my 20s. So
yeah.
But you know, that was a great experience though. But that's how I got out to LA. Once I got done with that, I came back to LA and was ready to fly back, met with Ann Geddes, Elizabeth's sister, who was in LA, and I think they're gone. I think the Geddes agency is done. They're not around anymore. But Ann Geddes was actually married to, and I can't remember his name now, he was the lieutenant on 21 Jump Street, big black guy.
Oh, sure. Okay, yeah. I know who you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, she was married to him, so I would see him every once in a while at the agency, you know. Which is really funny because then I ended up working in Booker with Richie Grieco, you know.
Yeah.
Getting to know Richie, you know. Mm. Oh, God. You know? And then he and I were both in some schlocky little other movie that Kurtzman did, you know, which was so funny. Bob Kurtzman, you know, who's K&B Effects and created Pumpkinhead and did, you know, a lot of that stuff or worked on that, you know, they didn't create him. Winston, I think, created Pumpkinhead, but. But yeah, Bruce Campbell was on that one too. Let's see. Oh,
yeah.
Guys, the, you know, Trejo was awesome to work with. You know, Danny Trejo.
Mm-hmm.
That was that Kathy Long Chopsaki movie, The Stranger.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I met Nils on that too. Nils Allen Stewart. He's a big Samoan looking dude, you know, with a Chinese ponytail.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a top knot, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Really, really sweet guy. That was the fun thing, was meeting, you know, these massive fighter dudes, you know, who were just the sweethearts of the world. You know what I mean?
I mean,
huge stuntmen. I loved hanging out with the stuntmen, the crew, and yeah, I'm still good friends with a lot of those guys. And I just ran into Andy. I've done two films with Andy Devoff. I did Another 48 Hours, and I did The Stranger with him.
Oh, nice. Cool.
And he and I are like brothers, but we don't see each other very often. So, you know, it's been more than 20 years since we'd actually seen each other. So
I just took
my girlfriend out to LA and took her to the Sequoia National Forest because she'd never seen those trees.
Oh, wow.
And got a chance to hang out in Echo Park and see my kids, and also go to dinner one night with a bunch of her old friends from, you know, acting 20 years ago. And then also Andy showed up, and he's doing great. He's starting a brewery. He's still acting.
Oh, wow.
Sweet.
That guy, he's an amazing, amazing dude. He speaks like 8 languages, you know, and
wow.
And, he, you know, he's had his turns on Lost. He goes to conventions as a guy from, you know, as the Russian guy from Lost.
Sure.
And oh, yeah.
The Wishmaster, you know, he is the djinn.
Yeah.
Okay.
right.
Yeah, but he's a good friend. So no, so far it's been a lot of fun. You know, Quantum Leap fits in with a lot of that. Just be, you know, this idea of getting to know the people on the set. You know, I mean, just
sure.
You know, it's a great collaborative thing, and I love that. That's what I think almost any actor will tell you, that that's really what the fun of making films is.
Yeah.
You know, it's a huge part of it, is that collaborative work. There's that occasional story of, like, you know, tyrannical directors and terrible conditions on set and blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
And it got this great performance out of this actor and blah, you know, but that's, I haven't experienced that necessarily.
Yeah.
I kind of would love to actually go through something like this. just to say that I had.
Sure.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You never worked on a profile show in Chicago?
Oh, God, no. I'm sorry. If I ever ran into that guy, I think I would probably tie him up and throw him in the river.
Yeah, man.
Oh, God.
It's so funny because Dennis and I were actually talking a little bit about that before we got started today. I don't even know exactly what brought us to it.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, we were chatting a bit and feel the same way.
I worked with, I recently did a play with one of the girls who was part of that whole thing.
Oh, yeah?
You know, so, you know, and she was awesome. She got Jeff recommended, you know, Jeff, you know, nominated when we went to the Jeff Awards for the play.
Oh, sure, yes. Yeah.
I hadn't done a play in over 30 years. The one I just did,
last year
got nominated, so.
What was it?
Foxfinder was the name.
Oh, okay,
of it.
Okay.
Yeah, at the Athenaeum Theater. It was in Tarabang Theater Company, which awesome itinerant theater company. Yeah.
Really, yeah, yeah.
Really good, you know. And this was a really provocative dystopian play. Really interesting,
sure.
You know. It came out during the time when Handmaid's Tale suddenly became popular on television. You know. On Hulu, right?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we're doing Foxfinder in this, you know, this dystopian England, you know, where it's closed off from the rest of the world and created its own, you know, society where it's now controlled by the ministry in a sense, you know, and farmers are under watchful eye to be able to produce what they need to produce in order to, as quota, or mm-hmm. they won't be given the farm anymore, you know, that kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
And they send out fox finders to come out as sort of these bizarre black cloaked Inquisition agents, you know, to come and stay at farms to see if things are right, you know, and to make sure that things are good, you know.
Yeah.
And it's under the guise of the fact that the fox now has been considered something almost mystical, like demon-like, like possessive and, you know, devilish. Mm-hmm. And nobody's seen a fox in years, but there's the stories of the idea that that's what destroyed society, you know, blah, 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 blah. But they took care of it and the government got rid of them, but you have to go out and see if there's any infestation. And it's the metaphor for, you know, immoral activity is there's that fox here, you know, that kind of thing. So really creepy.
Yeah.
Very creepy. But, yeah, and then Black Mirror, you know, I mean, stuff like that. It kind of fell in line with a lot of what was becoming popular at the time. Now, and
very cool.
It's always interesting to me how I think we tend to, as artists, just kind of tap into whatever's going on in the moment, and so you see a lot of similar pieces that are independent of one another. It's not a case of like copying each other or anything like that. It's just the idea that we're all kind of
influenced.
We can't help but tell the same story because we're all living in the same world, and you know, we have those feelings and those thoughts about what's going on. And I'm always fascinated by that. You know, and you hear it's sometimes it's a leap of faith, but when you'll hear a writer or a director say, "Oh, I wasn't aware that this even existed."
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, sorry. David, thank you so much. I mean, this has been great, man. I can't tell you how appreciative I am of you spending time with us and talking about everything.
Yeah. Michelle Dahmer, who I'm sure introduced us a couple years ago. And I'm sure you know her through the theater acting world too, because I know we met in a very different world. I'm a massage therapist, and for a while she was one of the enrollment people at the massage school that I worked at, and so that's how we came to be connected. But I know that she was active.
Okay.
Yeah, I know that she's at one point in time she was active in the theater world, in the theater scene. But yeah, we became Facebook friends over 2 years ago when she introduced us. Like, we did like a quick intro message back then, but it's like we were like back in the second season of the show at the time. Yeah. So we finally got to the fifth season now.
We're in the home stretch.
Yeah.
David, before you go, is there anything that you want to, you know,
plug?
Say about, any of the projects you're working on now or anything that you're doing now? I know you mentioned some music before we started recording. I hadn't hit record yet, but you were talking about some of the music projects that you've got going.
Yeah, the album is available right now on all digital platforms. It's been there for a while. I actually have physical CDs that I'm selling at shows, but in terms of easy download, Ancora Imparo is the name of the album, and it's a solo album that I did last year that is still selling, you know, moderately well, but needs even more push because I, you know, it's on Spotify, so it's on Amazon, it's on, you know, iTunes, it's on Pandora, it's everywhere, it's easy to find. But it was a labor of love that is out there that is first step, and I've got another album that I'm going to try to get done in the next year or so that is a lot more complicated.
Right on.
But in the meantime, I'm involved in a duo called Damn Jackson. We are performing around the North Side and the Northwest, out in Long Grove and in Palatine, and sometimes down in the city.
Okay.
And we're playing in Evanston on May 1st, actually. We're gonna
right
be,
on.
You know, at the Evanston Pub on May 1st, so that's going to be a lot of fun. And he's a multi-instrumentalist named Jack Mazenga, a great guy, really close friend, who is an amazing player. He plays fretless, so...
Oh, wow.
He can still play a guitar that has frets on it. But he's well known and has been written up in Guitar Player magazine for playing guitars that were fretless, where he's put a mirror finish on the fingerboard or he's put titanium on the fingerboard. So much like a classical artist, he's playing without any kind of designation of frets.
Wow.
So it's pretty amazing to play with him, and he's got a huge library in his head, and you know, he's introduced me to things that I never even got into when I was, you know, originally playing. I've been playing guitar since I was 8 years old. So I've been, you know, influenced by anything that you can think of, you know, everything from country to Mozart to punk to Caribbean to, you know, to blues to soul. I'm just all over the place, you know.
Yeah.
So I just love music. And that's kind of difficult when you're a writer, too, because I've got more than 130 songs, but I have not been able to get all of it recorded.
Sure.
You know, so... And then you start looking at that because time passes and you wonder if something is passé because it is stuck in a sort of time period or connected to something else. But then you realize that none of it really is. You can give it a little extra push and you're always going to find a niche one way or the other. You know, I mean, there was a time when it seemed like if you did not do a song and have a scratch in it, or some sort of hip hop influence to it, that it wasn't going to make it to the radio at all. You know what I mean? The reality is the mainstream would tell you that, but that's not the truth.
Right.
You know, singer songwriters and classic country and classic folk artists were still producing albums and selling albums to their fans.
Right.
Back in the '90s. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, and in the 2000s, the early 2000s, when it seemed like that's all, you know, all you heard on the radio was high influence of hip hop.
Right.
Which I don't dislike. That's not the point. You know what I mean? It's the idea of the moguls who are now younger A&R guys. They're not the old cigar chomping Jewish dudes who were like, I don't know, put it out there. Let's see who likes it.
Right.
You
know? Right.
Yeah. Now you got young A&R guys who are now my age, 50-something, who are going, we know what the public likes, and we're going to tell them what they like.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. we're going to show them this, and blah, 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 blah. And look how much money Beyonce makes. You know, so we're going to tell everybody that this is exactly what music needs to sound like. So, and then you're going to, and then we're going to reward all those posers, you know, that decide to do the same thing. On a business level, you can't really be judgmental about how that approach has been taken because it has made a lot of money for certain people, but it has abused other people and exploited other people along the way.
Right.
But you could say that of any billion dollar making enterprise, you know what I mean? That's the conversation now politically, this idea behind billionaires and Sanders take on Bloomberg. You know, you don't deserve all this money and you don't deserve all the praise for all this money because you weren't the only one who made the money.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I mean, you know, it should be spread equally among the people who made the money, you know, or not necessarily equally, but the reality is, you know, fair share. So that's the people that I think that's the thing that people don't understand about democratic socialism. I'm sorry to get political.
No, it's totally fine.
Again, have you listened to our podcast?
I mean, I'm just saying, you know what I mean? Because fair share does not mean that you can't get more than I can.
Right.
You
know what I mean? Exactly. Exactly.
If it's fair that you get it because you're a better businessman, then that's great. But it isn't fair that you should take all of it and that I don't get any.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Exactly.
So, yeah, exactly. So anyway. That's my story.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
No, it's my pleasure, and I love it. And you know, any time. So.
All right. Awesome.
All right.
Well, thank you so much, David. Take care. And on a selfish note, you mentioned some places that you playing and playing in the city and stuff. Have you heard of, been to, or played at a place called Montrose Saloon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the next time you're there, I'll definitely have to check you out because that's like a block away from where I live. I've played there a few times as well. So
yeah, have you gone to see the Handcuffs there?
I think I used to be there a lot, but it's been a while since I was there. My wife and I had a baby recently.
My friends Brad Elvis and his wife actually, you know, have a band called the Handcuffs.
Okay.
Yeah, and they are. It's great. Rock and roll, and Brad was the lead. He was the drummer for a band that I loved in college called Screams.
Yeah,
which was a under supported, awesome band that could have been bigger than Cheap Trick. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
And at the time,
I
and and got terribly promoted because they ended up being thrown out on a tour with Van Halen, which makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
But they were club favorites, and they did really well for a while, and their album is so well done.
Yeah.
It's a good album of that kind of rock and roll, and it just sucks for people who were fans of Screams at the time, you know what I mean, to see that they can go any further. That being said, Brad moved on and did the Elvis Brothers, and they did really well on a club circuit and with, you know, local people. And then he ended up becoming the drummer for the Romantics. So he's been very, very busy. But he and his wife, actually, who is an awesome saxophone player and an awesome guitar player and a great lead singer and a great lead presence in the style of somebody that fits right in with early Rod Stewart or Ron, you know, or Ron Wood or
sure.
Anybody from that time period where, you know, or now I'm blanking on the guy that I get asked about all the time because I'm also in a Bowie cover band.
Oh, okay.
and not a cosplay cover, you know, tribute band, but just a cover band.
Mm, sure.
And I always get asked if we do dress up and that if I'm going to dress up like the guitar player and all of a sudden I'm
Ronson. His last name is Ronson. What's the first? Is it Mick? Mark?
Mick. Rob. Yeah, it's
Mick Ronson, right?
Ronson.
Yeah.
Ronson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Ronson. Yeah. And that's so Ronson also had that look. You know
yeah.
What I mean?
Totally. Sort
of the spiky, you know, whatever over. And then she's and Chloe Orwell is her name.
Okay.
Which is a great name anyway.
But, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, they're a blast. They are really cool, and I keep promising to go out to their gigs, and I don't, you know.
Sure.
I get too tied up, and I'm too busy, whatever. But I think we're going to be jamming with them. I think the Bowie band is going to be playing with them, and also with Tiberius Strange. I actually have on schedule, I think. I wonder if it's the Montrose Saloon that we're going to be playing at, actually, a few months from now.
Okay.
So, yeah, so I'll keep you updated.
Cool. Yeah. Please.
Watch, because I'll be posting, you know, and I'm trying to really be good about a lot of that. I'm using Instagram more than I ever have, you know, so.
Yeah.
But I've, you know, if you haven't seen that, I've created an actor page on both Facebook and also an actor page on Instagram.
Okay.
And just use my regular sites. I've got like five pages on Facebook, you know, because I've got Damn Jacks, and then I've got the David Anthony Marshall Music, and then I've got David Anthony Marshall Actor, and then just David Marshall, and then, you know, I've got all of that going on. And Space Face as well. You know, Space Face is the Bowie band.
Okay, nice. Cool. Well, we'll definitely include links in the show notes so people can find you and everything from the podcast as well. But on a personal note, yeah, I hope to check it out and bump into you face to face sometime. But thank you again so much for doing this. We really appreciate it. You've been so generous with your time. And we'll be speaking again sooner rather than later.
Yeah, sounds good. All right. Check out the podcast I did last year too from the Sesh.
All right,
that's a really good podcast they did where my episode is all in black and white, and you'll see Jack playing Lynn too.
Awesome. Oh. All right, that sounds great. Well, cool. Well, thank you so much, David. Take care. Have a great rest of your Sunday, and we'll hit you.
Once again, a huge thank you to David Anthony Marshall. He was such a great sport. It was really fun chatting with him. You know, in addition to obviously taking part in Quantum Leap, had a lot of other really interesting stories to talk about and tell us about his experience as a professional working actor and some of the cool, fun things that he got to experience along the way. Really enjoyed hearing his stories about Lock Up. As I mentioned in the interview, as a kid, I caught that movie late at night and watched it numerous times. There was just something I really enjoyed about that particular Stallone flick. So we are planning again on amping up our recordings, so you should be getting quite a few episodes dropped over the next week or so. And we look forward to hearing what you have to say. Obviously, we don't expect you to listen to every single one as they come out because we're going to just bank a lot of stuff, but we want to release it during this time in case you are interested in doing your own Quantum Leap marathon and want to listen along with us. So be on the lookout for those new episodes. Killin' Time is dropping concurrently with this interview episode, and then Starlight, Starbright will be up shortly thereafter. So we're really, really looking forward to doing our own mini marathon over here and recording our episodes as we are in the home stretch of season 5. So Dennis and I are recording remotely, but staying in contact and figuring out ways that we can have fun with the community. So feel free to make posts on the Facebook page, hit us up on Twitter, send us an email, drop us an audio recording. We'll drop you into the show. It doesn't even have to be about the episode we're talking about, just Quantum Leap in general. Give us your top 10 episodes, the episodes that you plan on watching while you're social distancing and self-quarantining. We'd love to hear that. But again, in closing, thanks so much to David Anthony Marshall. You can find him at davidanthonymarshall.com. Or you can, of course, hit him up on Facebook at facebook.com/ChicagoMarshall. And be on the lookout, of course, for his music projects as well as the films that he mentions. You can also find him on IMDb to take a look at his career and track down different performances. I know that we've already had a few people reach out to us commenting about catching him in films like 48 Hours and so on. So we look forward to hearing from you again. Stay well, take care of yourselves and one another, and we'll be coming at you real soon with Starlight, Starbright.
Our hearts may touch, our bodies close.